Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Ellen Akami, who is a postdoc research associate in digital culture and society at the University of Liverpool, about her new book, Media Distortions, Understanding the Power Behind Spam, Noise, and Other Deviant Media. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dave, for inviting me.
This is so interesting, this book, and it's kind of like perfect timing, given the fact that all of a sudden whole swathes of the world have migrated online for their work, and you know, their kind of digital lives have been accelerated by the current pandemic crisis that is the backdrop to this this recording. And it's funny in a way, because, you know, academic books obviously take a long time to write. I guess, you know, this is the product of several years' work, but it does feel so kind of well timed and so relevant. And I guess the place to start with the book is, if you could say a bit about kind of how you got interested in writing about this, and where the kind of the overall project has come from.
Yes, that's a really good question. I first want to just emphasize that the book is open access, so people can actually, and there's a whole website that I dedicated to it. There's a playlist, and there is more information that didn't manage to go inside the book. So if you want, you can check it through my Twitter account, but you can just also type Media Distortions, and then you can find it and download the book. So the book is roughly based on my PhD. Thesis, but of course I had to write it in a more engaging way, which for me is actually more fun, because I used to be a journalist. We talked about it before. I used to be also a radio broadcaster. So for me, actually writing in academic language was never a natural way of communicating ideas. And I think also my past in, I used to work also in music labels, and write about music, electronic dance music. My first book is about the Israeli psychedelic trance culture. And the radio shows were also about music. So I think that for me, as sort of an entry point, thinking about media culture, digital culture through sound concepts was something that I wanted to explore. I think that the book sort of went through a lot of different stages. I even had several things that didn't quite materialize. But what I was, I think, very intrigued by is this kind of notion that spam is only something that is talked about through computer scientists' sort of narratives and frameworks. And I was really intrigued by that, because I thought that it's such an important thing. And actually, we have very little information about that. And I wanted to explore that more. And the more that I explored, the more I realized that it has a lot more politics than we realize. So for me, actually, this book, one of the main things is that as media scholars, but also sociologists, and historians and anthropologists, it's quite important not to take for granted a lot of the way that computer scientists tell us how computers and internet and different kind of sort of network cultures work, and try to challenge that and tell different stories and sort of peel off the politics behind that.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned the kind of, you know, the playlist and the overall, I guess, kind of maybe like media presence of the book, because, you know, it would be slightly kind of unusual, I suppose, for an academic book to have a playlist associated with it. But that tells us something about the way you approach this question of spam and what your kind of method is. And one of the things you talk about, you know, early on in the book, but also provides a kind of framework, is this idea of a kind of like listening approach. And I was really struck by that, because it's, you know, kind of slightly unusual, I suppose, for academic analysis, but it adds, you know, incredible amounts of value, actually. So what is this sort of listening approach to these these questions of things like media power?
So I think when we talk about media power, we almost exclusively talk about it through vision, invisibilities, and different kind of metaphors of vision. Also, another really prominent metaphor is black box. And while I think that they are good metaphors, I think that they don't really encapsulate the kind of the multiplicities and the complexities that we're talking about when we're talking about media infrastructures, which are always multi-layered and have a lot of different kind of actors. And so because sound and specifically listening allows us to sort of cross boundaries of what is public and what is private, which is a concept that I focus on quite a lot in the book, I felt that this is a better way to understand what is happening in the sort of the three stories that I'm talking about. So I think that listening sort of involves a selection and attention to different kind of things, but it also allows us to tune in and out of spaces. And I felt this is something that is more productive when we think and theorize digital cultures. And again, it's not that I want to replace all of the way that we're talking about these different kind of objects or practices, but I think it's really good for us to start thinking or sort of broadening the way that we talk about these things.
And it's quite, not contrast perhaps, but it kind of complements some of the key theorists in the book as well. So, you know, the kind of classic approach through Foucault is, you know, as you mentioned, you know, quite a visual one, thinking about things like panopticons, you know, that kind of classic image of Bentham's plans and stuff that, you know, is probably quite familiar to listeners of this podcast. And, you know, the kind of the listening approach is something different and a compliment. But I guess the question is like listening, you know, around and about what? And before we get into your three stories, your three examples, we probably need to know a bit about what actually is this thing spam, which, you know, opens this, you know, whole kind of question about what is deviant media? What are we talking about when we're talking about noise? But quite early on in the book, you try and get to grips with like what spam is and how, you know, it's had maybe different eras or different epochs.
Yeah. So again, when I was starting this project, a really fun thing happened that Finn Brunton published his book about spam. So I'm guessing a lot of scholars who are doing research about something, that's a moment where you're like, shit, you know, what should I do? Because somebody's writing a really great book about that. But what I realized is that Finn Brunton also sort of adopted these kind of common understandings about what spam is. And I wanted to understand it in different ways. And how could maybe we think of spam in different kind of technologies and in different kind of times? And so the book is basically divided into three examples where I look at three types of deviant media categories. The earlier one is noise. The sort of the more contemporary one is spam. And then I'm talking about antisocial. And basically what I show through these kind of three stories and three deviant media categories is the way that media practitioners try to shape our behaviors and understanding in specific way. And this is where the sort of the power structure and the power relation and the power asymmetries that they create happens. And I wanted to explore that by unpacking these kind of our common understandings. And I cannot emphasize enough how many times when I talk to people and they say, oh, so you're doing research on spam. Maybe you can solve all of the Viagra emails that I'm getting. And I was like, first of all, no. Second of all, I was so struck by how everybody has one way of thinking about it. And I was really, I wanted to sort of peel the layers of this, these misconceptions and the politics around them. So spam doesn't really have a specific definition, and it shapes in different forms. And it's basically the way that media practitioners or media companies want to define things that sort of harm their business model at a particular time in a particular space. And I guess as we go along in this podcast, I'll explain a bit more what does that mean.
Yeah, I mean, I was really struck by the dominance of what's good for the business model as being this really kind of crucial theme that shapes all these different kinds of practices, whether it's, you know, legal regimes at the EU level, whether it's like, you know, the kind of technical architecture of Facebook, or a more sort of kind of traditional example, which is around New York, the Bell Telephone Company, and the way that kind of like certain things were mapped as noise and certain things were not. And I suppose that story of Bell is a really nice way of telling the story of the kind of the business model focus that runs throughout the book. So yeah, who were Bell, or who are Bell? You know, what was their kind of attempt to almost kind of control New York City and the noise in the city?
So again, just before I start to explain that, I just want to say that with spam and noise, which I'm going to explain now, what I did is basically analyze different kind of technical material, but also legal material, which are usually the material that is presented as if it's like neutral or objective. And I peel these layers of objectivity and show how there is a decision-making process in deciding what is deviant and what is the norm. And this is where the politics starts to get complicated. So with Bell Telephone Company, which is one of the biggest media companies that ever existed. So when we're thinking about companies like Google and Facebook, Bell Telephone were pretty much bigger than them, at least at that time. And we're talking about the 1929, which is the time where the stock market crashed. So it was a time of a lot of uncertainties. And as we realize with now, and a lot of these kind of uncertainties, it allows for media companies to sort of reshape their position as important actors that can have decisions of how social structures are going to be defined and sort of ordered. And I think that we also see that now with the COVID, where when we see the whole debate about the contact tracing apps and the kind of dominance of technology companies in deciding about basically social issues. And I think that this is part of what I'm trying to say, is that actually we should be very careful about allowing these kind of big companies making decisions that are so important in our societies. So in the early 20th century, Bell Telephone Company partnered with the Noise Abatement Commission. And basically what they were trying to do is to create this kind of noise map in order to understand what are specific behaviors and what kind of specific spaces are really noisy. And that was also a time where a lot of different kind of technologies were being developed. And this Noise Abatement Committee was consisting of different kind of interest group, which included insulation companies and real estate companies who wanted basically to reshape New York City as a more commercial friendly space. And in order to do that, they partnered with Bell Telephone, who wanted to position themselves as an important company to consult with, but also in how people can think about their relations. So that was the time where they developed the decibel, which was a measuring unit, but also they developed different kind of instruments to measure different types of behaviors. Now, of course, only Bell Telephone Company engineers could basically tell you what is noisy and what is not. So they had the power to establish this kind of division between what is noise and what is not. And not surprisingly, the kind of the people and the spaces where they defined as noisy were people who interfered with the sort of the interest group that formed this committee, which were Black Americans, foreigners, people who sold different kind of things on the streets without license. And so tagging them and sort of categorizing them as noisy allowed them to to create this kind of distinction and try to educate people to what kind of things are should be become the new social and what kind of things should be filtered out of our society.
I mean, you mentioned this idea particularly of race, and you know, some of the examples that really struck me in that chapter were around things like, you know, jazz clubs being immediately seen as kind of illegitimate and a problem, and then, you know, muzak in elevators and in these kind of, you know, commercial spaces being like, oh yeah, they're totally fine, which is one of those things that is kind of, you know, depressing in its I suppose the simplicity of the example. And that chapter, you know, is really I think clear about this, about the power not just to kind of, you know, define particular behaviors and individuals as deviant, but also, you know, to almost kind of reshape the city and the entire world around this. And that reshaping comes through really clearly in the next example, which is around the EU. And I guess, I mean, I wonder if this is the right kind of understanding, but I guess the EU's failure to regulate things like digital advertising, or is that perhaps too strong?
I don't know if it's a failure, because it was an intention to be like that. So it is a failure, but it is an intention to provide more power to technology companies, and to allow that through a different kind of legislation that gave more power to technology companies and different kind of instruments, which allowed mechanisms that today we see for granted. And in those times, these were crucial times to think about which kind of communication do we want to have, how are we going to define different kind of things, which kind of roles of each kind of the players in this online new territory is going to have. So it is a failure, I think, for us as citizens, but I'm not sure that, you know, for governments it is. And I think that I'm quite amazed how a lot of people have sort of brushed the whole cookies and a lot of the things that were developed at that time, cookies, pixels, and talk about today in different kind of surveillance, and already moved to artificial intelligence and all of these kind of things, where the main things that enable that and enable everything that we think about today, basically Facebook, Amazon, all of these things were cemented and sort of naturalized and sort of licensed and normalized in that time.
And also at the same time, there's the creation of, in that kind of, you know, classic sort of Foucauldian sense, the creation of a particular kind of subjectivity. This idea you talk about as the creation of an EU data subject, which I found both, you know, a kind of an interesting sort of concept, and then was struck by, you know, the extent to which we, you know, both in Britain for a while, but also across Europe, are these data subjects that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think when I'm talking about the data subject, I'm basically talking about how the digital advertising industry, together with tech industries, wanted to produce people as data subjects, basically this kind of consumers who are passively navigating within these kind of default settings, architectures that structure their possibilities, their ways of living. And this is where, again, Foucault sort of comes into place, because basically what Foucault talks about when he's talking about power is the power to structure specific possibilities of living. So I think one of the best examples is the both the default setting of browsers, but also the consent mechanism. So if you live in European Union, you know that if you go on websites, you get this box that says, do you agree? Do you consent? And most people don't really understand what that means. And in a lot of the cases, first of all, you sometimes don't even have the option to say, no, I don't agree. And I think these kind of computational options, which seem quite innocent and so on, are quite powerful in a way to narrow our understanding of what is possible within these infrastructures. What kind of things can we demand from these companies? What is actually happening? Can we negotiate with companies? And this kind of division of what is happening in the back end and what is happening in the front end, which is another thing that I talk about, this kind of default setting of browsers, that you can't really see what's happening in the back end, which was a result of lobbying of the advertising industry. So actually one of the cookie standards, so one of the things that I do, I analyze different kind of technical standards. I've analyzed the cookie standard, and what I realized that actually what's written there in the first draft, at least, is that the people who drafted it recommend for people to see what's happening in the back end. So a lot of the things that we can sort of see today, the amount of cookies that are sent to your computer and so on. And the advertising industry said, no, this is going to confuse people. We have too many things. You can't confuse them with that. Now, I'm sure that like me, you have at least 20 tabs open at the moment. And so people are not really confused by seeing a lot of things. And actually, it helps people understand what's happening in the back end and maybe be more informed about these kind of things. So what we're seeing is with these kind of technical options, which are totally intentional and can totally be also different if we wanted them or if we demanded them, shaped how we engage with these platforms. And this had significant results and sort of implication in what's happening now, because now a lot of people, I think, do not demand different kind of things from technology companies because they just are not aware that they can. So cementing these kind of options in the early 2000s helped shape a specific sort of online citizen that is very passive, and it's not really asking a lot of questions of how things are working, what kind of things can I demand, could things be designed in different ways? And this is very crucial to a lot of the things that we're experiencing today.
I mean, everything you said would have been just a really straightforward description of, you know, so many problems with Facebook. And obviously Facebook is crucial to the last part of the book. It's the final kind of detailed engagement or case study in the book. And yeah, you know, this idea of a particular set of architectural choices that favors the corporation, people's, you know, potential sort of, at least, you know, lack of asking for different options or maybe passivity in the face of Facebook. All of these, you know, are kind of crucial themes. And before we talk about, again, you know, the kind of the Facebook subject and its, you know, kind of ordering of our contemporary world, I'm also interested in kind of like how you went about researching Facebook, and you raise in the book, you know, that kind of problem you mentioned it earlier of, you know, trying to do research on something that is not constantly changing, but, you know, either new scandals emerge or, you know, kind of new points for research potentially kind of make things a bit, you know, kind of slightly out of date or obsolete. So what was your kind of approach to dealing with the problem of how you research Facebook?
I think like a lot of internet researchers, this is one of the most frustrating thing, because literally every time you write about something, something else is changing. There's a lot of lawsuits against Facebook. There's a lot of revelation happening every time. I remember even as I was like writing the last revisions of the book, there were things happening. And so it kind of is overwhelming. But I think that once you try to have a question and what is your main argument, then, you know, it doesn't matter if things keep on changing. It's the actual questions and the actual themes that you're trying to research. And I think I quote Jonathan Stern's really great argument about that when he says, why do we have, you know, why do you still rely on different kind of theories of, you know, Stuart Hall, who's talking about television. And, you know, while the specific examples might not apply, the kind of the broader questions that he's asking about encoding, decoding still matter today. And he also talks about Bourdieu. So I think I took that as, okay, you know, I'm not going to be able to capture everything all the time. But what are the kind of big questions that I want to ask here, which will still sort of be applicable, even if things are going to move very fast? And so I remember I started to analyze the terms of use, and I cataloged it every 2 weeks for more than a year, different kind of terms, trying to see. But I think one of the things that have contributed the most to this chapter was Facebook research archive. So maybe people are not aware, but actually Facebook publishes academic articles that are published in peer-reviewed journals, which is a whole different discussion of if they should be allowed to do that in general. But basically, I developed this method, which I called a platform reverse engineering, which is I take these articles and I try to sort of understand what are the things that they focus on, how do they rationalize their research. Importantly, what kind of tools are they using? Because being a Facebook researcher obviously means that you have access to a lot of the tools that they have. But that can also indicate what kind of tools they're using, what kind of things matter to them when they're talking about their research. And that helped me to uncover a lot of the things. And so, for example, a clear example of that is the audience selector, which was a feature that Facebook developed. And when they developed it, the way that they showed it, oh, people can have more control on the kind of things that are sort of they share with different kind of audiences. It could be only to you, it could be only to your friends, or it could be to the open public. But basically, Facebook has done this, sort of developed this feature in order to encourage people to contribute and to share more information about them, to feel more safe, to share more things about them. Because for them, the more you share, the more value they get. So this helped me sort of see what kind of language are they using in order to rationalize the development of different kind of features. And so I think that, you know, as researchers, we need to be very creative. One of the things that I've done, and I haven't included in the book, but I know that others are doing at the moment, like Tero Korpi in his new book, is to analyze Facebook patents and try to understand what they're doing there. So I think as researchers, we basically can use the kind of the only things that are available to us and try to see what kind of things they bring back to us.
I mean, you've given a really great example, actually, of that sense of, you know, how Facebook kind of produces people who are, you know, or maybe produces behaviors, subjectivities that are really keen to share things, which, you know, seemingly is like, you know, a kind of maybe a neutral or even good thing, but actually at the same time is precisely about contributing to the business model, you know, is precisely about how Facebook ultimately kind of makes money. And I think, you know, you can see the line between the three case studies about this maybe sort of transforming but consistent focus on that kind of, you know, getting out of the way of the business model doing its work. And I suppose it raises the question of, you know, how do we sort of like resist this or get around it? You know, is it a matter of, you know, just kind of saying, on the one hand, well, you know, we need to make more spam and more noise, be more kind of deviant. Is it a matter of, you know, kind of opting out of these systems? I must admit, I don't have a Facebook, but because of, you know, kind of other bits of tech I use, I'm, you know, inevitably kind of interacting with it. Or do you have other, you know, kind of visions of sort of resistance and alternatives?
I have several ideas that I was thinking while I was writing the book. One of them is, I think the key thread of these three stories is the attempt of media companies to commercialize more and more spaces and more territories of our social lives. And so for me, the starting point would be to provide maybe other types of mediated spaces where we can connect. So that could be done through an internet tax, because if we're thinking about the internet as a public utility, then we have other places and spaces where we can communicate with each other, where the main business model is not to commodify our lives. So to me, that would be a first starting point. The second point of alternatives would be to decentralize technologies, because at the moment we have very few companies that have too much power to decide. And they infiltrate into so many different spaces, banking, health. They want to now they want to take over health as well with the, what we're seeing with COVID. And I think it's quite important for us to have multiple different kind of technologies, which are also local. So one of the problem with these companies is that most of them come from the U.S., and their motto is to scale up things, right? How can we do something that sort of applies to everybody, but according to our rules? And one of the things that are missing there are these kind of nuances of localized interpretation. So when we're thinking about these kind of deviant media categories, the problem with that is that if you have a big company that is so centralized, it can decide what is the deviant according to that. I talk a bit about that also in a article that's going to come out soon as part of a panel that we had about content moderation at the Association of Internet Researchers Association. And I talk about how TikTok, which is a Chinese company, how they define different kind of thing as deviant, and they define deviant people who are ugly, old, but also different kind of spaces which are poor and so on. And so TikTok is another big company, Chinese company. And again, this is one of the problems when we have these kind of huge companies. So sort of decentralized technologies, which are more local, second alternative. The third alternative, which is quite crucial, is re-examining how we value different kind of media workers. And this comes, and this is where I focus on both the telephone operators, which are now sort of portrayed as commercial content moderators, which is a concept that was coined by Sarah Roberts. So I think one of the things that we saw again with COVID, and I'm so happy, I'm not happy that it happened, but I'm happy that people sort of, this pandemic, as horrible as it is, it helps us think about things differently, because a lot of things that weren't possible before are now possible. And so what we saw with Facebook, if you remember, sent away all of their content moderators who are in their countries, their Philippines or different kind of countries in Asia. And they started to do content moderation through AI. And what we saw then is that they tag a lot of different kind of disinformation as okay, whereas important things like how to create DIY masks were categorized as spam. And what we saw then is that actually the job of human content moderators is so important, because they're human, they have this kind of ability to understand nuances and context and what matters to people. And so I think with the COVID, as we started to realize that people that we previously didn't value so much, such as teachers or delivery people, and nurses, and we saw how valuable they are to our society, and also that a lot of these people are happen to be people of color and women, I think that this is a time for us to reevaluate how we want to value and hire and compensate and think about these people, and not only to value people who are, for example, the programmers of and engineers of media companies. So if we can think about people in this kind of the chain differently and value them differently, I think that this is also would be a way forward.